TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. Joining us in the studio is Observer staff writer Melissa Del Bosque and also Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels. And somehow all three of us have avoided the South by Southwest traffic and made it into the studio today. Thanks for being here, guys. I know the free drinks and the music were tempting.
Yeah, indeed. Good to be here.
Later in the program, we'll be joined by freelance writer and frequent Observer contributor Robin Ross to talk about her latest story, Laid to Rest in Huntsville. Roughly 450 inmates die in Texas prisons each year. About 100 of them are buried in Captain Joe Byrd Cemetery in Huntsville. Still later in the program, we'll be joined by Houston-based writer Anish Shivani and author James Magnuson to discuss his new novel, Famous Writers I Have Known. But first, we have some news to discuss, and unlike most of the time, the news begins with very clean bathrooms, beaver nuggets, and a convenience store chain's endorsement of Dan Patrick for Lieutenant Governor. Guys, what do you think about this Buc-ee's situation?
Well, apparently it wasn't the chain that endorsed him after all. It was just the people who run it.
I see.
And this was a nuance that came out after a massive boycott against Buc-ee's. Dan Patrick announced on his Facebook page that he was pleased to have the endorsement of Buc-ee's and had a photo of him in a t-shirt that says Texas TX, and he's hugging the beaver mascot from Buc-ee's.
Buc-ee.
Which I guess is named Buc-ee.
I guess you would assume.
Buc-ee the beaver.
Buc-ee the beaver.
And he says, I love stopping at Buc-ee's for their snacks, mm-hmm. and their bathrooms are very clean, and my wife and I, or he said my wife enjoys the bathrooms, mm-hmm. and we shop there for Christmas. And this is how he announced his, endorsement from Buc-ee's. Joaquin and Julian Castro both, I believe, announced that they would boycott the chain.
Right, they won't fuel up there.
Right. In response to Dan Patrick's views on immigration policy, for one thing. And so on Twitter, this is all pretty much played out on Facebook and Twitter. You know, Dan Patrick announced the endorsement of the owners of Buc-ee's on Facebook.
Right.
The Castros announced their boycott on mm-hmm. Twitter, and then there's the boycott Buc-ee's hashtag that took off over the next few days, and there were photos of people punching the Buc-ee statues outside the gas stations and doing all kinds of other things to voice
really
their disapproval.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cartoon beaver. Just why? Why the senseless violence?
I'm wondering who's getting these Christmas presents from Buc-ee's.
I was thinking
that
too.
What kind of Christmas present is that?
Hey,
I
whoa.
Can actually speak to that. They have an extensive selection of outdoor gear.
Robin Ross, everybody.
Hunting paraphernalia, Christian-themed T-shirts.
Beef jerky.
And what might be called down-home decor.
Down-home? I'd say I had no idea.
Picture frames with rhinestone-embellished crosses.
Anything with, horseshoes?
Okay. Probably.
Yeah.
So the more you talk about it, the less of a surprise this should have been in the first place.
I would
then.
Think so.
Yeah.
Well, now, who are these people? Okay, so it's not the owners of Buc-ee's.
It is the owners.
It is the owners
mm-hmm.
of Buc-ee's.
It's two owners, and apparently they've been Republican donors for quite a while.
Maybe we should stop discussing all the wonderful things you can buy at Buc-ee's and spend a little bit of time talking about Dan Patrick's stance on immigration. He's been talking about it in the lead-up to the primary for certain. What can we tell the listeners here about his stance?
Well, I mean, Buc-ee's is just the latest massive gas pump littered battlefield mm-hmm. on which the immigration policy battle has been waged between Dan Patrick and Julian Castro, who've agreed to debate immigration policy, and their views are sort of 180 degrees removed from one another, and the debate hasn't happened yet. But Patrick has been saying all kinds of inflammatory things about the invasion from our border and sort of doing all he can to undo the state Republican Party's efforts to kind of make reach out to Latino voters.
Well, and then we had the whole flap over him hiring a Mexican worker, right? And then saying, I'm not friendly to Mexicans. And
he denied having, written a letter in support of this guy's attempt to get citizenship.
Right.
And the guy had told, it was, I think, Dewhurst's people were sort of flaming and fanning the flames of this. And the worker had said, he was very kind to me. And Dan Patrick writes a letter that says, no, I was not kind to this guy after all.
I mean, the whole rhetoric on the part of Dan Patrick strikes me as such a short-sighted tactic in order to win. I mean, he's really screwing up the Republican Party's chances of appealing to any Latino voters in Texas. I know they've made some efforts, but really I think Dan Patrick's just really reversing pretty much any advances that they've made through his rhetoric and the things that he's said in just the recent months.
I mean, for right now, for his efforts to become lieutenant governor, it sure seems to be working.
Well, it worked in the primary, but how is this going to shape up if he, you know, I mean, well, he's got to get through the runoff first against Dewhurst, but how is this going to... I think he's doing Leticia Vandepute a big favor, you know, who will be his Democratic rival for lieutenant governor, right, really, with the rhetoric that he's putting out there. I can't see him appealing to any Latinos in Texas.
And I suppose there's no downside for Julian Castro, the mayor of San Antonio, to, you know, keep ribbing him over Twitter over this. And
yeah, I mean, I think Dan Patrick's, you know, whatever rhetoric, this sort of harsh rhetoric and xenophobia that he's putting out might do well for him in the Republican primary, but it's not going to get him anywhere in a statewide race, you know, with Democratic voters and you know, 38% Latino population. I just think it's very short-sighted, and you know, he's just not doing himself or his or the party any favors.
Meanwhile, there are some actually pretty big developments in news of what's happening on the border that you don't hear Dan Patrick talking much about.
Right. Nice segue. Thank you, Patrick. well, I mean, anybody who's listened to this podcast knows that I have been covering this issue since at least 2010, and that's the issue of unaccompanied migrant children crossing the border. And since at least 2011, we've had what government officials here in the U.S. are referring to as a surge of children. It's an unprecedented amount of kids coming across from mostly from three countries in Central America, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. So I just did a post today about this issue because the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees just put out a report yesterday. And what they've done is they've interviewed more than 400 of these children who are in detention to find out why they're leaving the countries and coming here to seek asylum and sort of what's behind the surge of all these children who are coming.
So do we have some clear answers?
Well, yeah, we do. I mean, we have some interesting findings. First of all, what they're saying, though, which I think is important, is that they're saying that many of these kids should qualify for asylum, which is important because, especially in the case of Mexican children, and I did a story back in 2010 called Children of the Exodus, and what happens with unaccompanied Mexican children, these are children who are traveling without an adult relative or parent or anything, they're just on their own.
Yeah.
And we're talking kids as young as sometimes 7 years old.
Right.
It's between 7 and 18. You'll even see kids younger than 7 sometimes who are traveling on their own. And what happens with the Mexican kids is that usually they're picked up by Border Patrol and they're just returned within about 24 hours to the closest Mexican border city. So they don't even get screened, even though there's a congressional mandate saying that they should be screened to see if they qualify for asylum. You know, an asylum meaning that they're being threatened by organized crime or you know, governmental groups, the police, things like that.
Is that what's leading these children to make the journey?
Well, and that's what's leading the children to make the journey. That was the finding in the report from the United Nations, was that especially in El Salvador and Mexico, what's happening is there's just an unbelievable level of organized crime and violence, and especially in El Salvador, gang violence that's pushing children to leave because they're being persecuted by the gangs, they're being recruited, and they're being abused and attacked, so they have really no choice, they feel.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is this more of an escape from being recruited into the gangs?
Yeah, it's an escape from being recruited, from being killed or attacked by them, or, yeah, from becoming a gang member.
Right, avoiding that lifestyle.
Avoiding that lifestyle. And the police and the government have shown a real inability to do anything to protect citizens or, you know, children from the gangs and from the organized crime syndicates. So as a result, we have this unprecedented number of kids who are coming here now. So the UN is saying, you know, we need to start recognizing this problem.
Guys, thanks for sharing those stories.
Sure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. And every month in the Observer, we dedicate part of the magazine to a feature we call Postcards, stories about particular places around Texas. For the March issue, freelance writer Robin Ross wrote about Huntsville, and more specifically about a cemetery there where roughly 100 inmates are buried each year. Robin, can you tell us a little bit more about Captain Joe Bird Cemetery?
Sure. So we have about 109 units in the Texas Department of Criminal Justice and a total of 150,000 prisoners, or offenders, as TDCJ calls them, and about 450 people die in prison each year, mostly of natural causes or chronic conditions. And about 100 of them, their families don't claim the body for whatever reason, which is generally because they can't afford a funeral of their own. And so in that case, the state of Texas pays for funeral costs, and the inmate is buried in Captain Joe Bird Cemetery, which is a prison-only cemetery in Huntsville, very close to the Sam Houston State campus and very close to the Walls Unit, which is the very old prison in the center of Huntsville that most people know for the execution chamber, which is there.
So why aren't these bodies claimed?
Well, in most cases, it's because the family can't afford it. I mean, there's some variety. There are prisoners who die and they have lost touch with all their family. The family has cut them off. They simply haven't maintained contact for whatever reason. It's been years and years since they talked to family members. So that's one reason. In other cases, when the death occurs, the warden or the chaplain at that unit tries to reach out to the family. And so in some cases, they can't find somebody in time. They might later.
Right.
And so sometimes they actually end up moving the body to a cemetery months later if they find a relative at that point.
Oh, wow.
But in the majority of cases, people just can't pay for the funeral, because an average funeral in the U.S. right now costs between $7,000 and $8,000, which excludes buying a cemetery plot or the other cemetery expenses. And so that's not money that a lot of these families have. The state is able to have a funeral and bury the deceased prisoners for about $2,000. And so what happens is a lot of times you'll get families who don't claim the body, but then they end up coming to the funeral because their failure to claim the body wasn't so much about disowning their relative.
Right.
And it was just about the fact that they couldn't pay for the funeral.
And so what is the scene like when, you know, a family shows up at Captain Joe Bird Hill and witnesses, you know, a funeral?
Well, things start really early in the morning. They start at about 7 because the funeral home that has the contract for this job brings the bodies from the funeral home to a Baptist church. And so if the families are going to come, they have the opportunity to do a viewing at the church at that time. And then starting around 9 in the morning, they do the funerals. So this cemetery it's not a huge place. I mean, you can easily walk across it in 10 minutes or less. It's on a little bit of a sloping hill, and they start out with a funeral service up at a little pavilion, and then they move the body down. And then at that point, another really interesting thing about this is that the people who attend the funerals for those whose families don't show up are other inmates, because there's a cemetery crew based at the Walls Unit there in Huntsville that does the digging and maintains the cemetery, and then also is the people who attend the funeral if nobody else does. And that's, you know, that sounds really poignant. What I realized, as with many many situations that reporters get into, is what seems really fascinating from the outside is just everyday work,
right,
and everyday life circumstances for people on the inside. And so I turned up expecting things to be very grim, very lonely, you know, very emotional. And it was just, I mean, it was poignant, but it was just kind of the day's business.
Right. It seemed like you had a couple of voices from inmates in your story that said, you know, that kind of had a realization about life and valuing it. But I guess I take it there were others who were just like, you know, something to break the time or something to just do.
Well, I just had the opportunity to talk to a couple of folks. And I know that some of them had met with media before. And I think that their response was a very appropriate thing to say. I mean, I think that their work probably does make them think about where they want to die, for sure, you know, that they don't want to be buried there. They don't want to be out of touch with their family. I wish that I had the opportunity to probe them a little bit more about what they think happens to them after they die, because that was another really interesting thing about attending those funerals, is that there was very much an assumption about an afterlife and about our actions while we were alive influencing where we go and what happens to us after we die. That was a pretty Christian worldview, and it seemed to be shared among everybody who was there, at least everybody who was talking who was there. And I, you know, I wondered if there were deviations from that other days that I wasn't there.
I'm really curious, Robin, what brought you to this story? Because you always find the most fascinating sort of historical places to write about in Texas. So what brought you to the story and what sort of drew you to it?
Thanks. So I was driving home one day and I heard a story by Joy Diaz on KUT. And she was talking about a lawyer who does pro bono divorce work for death row inmates. And there was a lot there. There were about five or six stories kind of rolled into one. And she just happened to mention in passing this cemetery where prisoners were buried. And I thought, wait a second, that sounds really interesting. And so I wanted to go find out more about that thing she'd mentioned in passing.
It does almost seem kind of quaint, you know, that, I don't know, so much other stuff that the state does is outsourced or doesn't really, you know, the idea that there's the cemetery for the prisons that's still on the prison grounds now, kind of old-fashioned.
Yeah, and there used to be a local funeral home used to have the contract. Now the funeral home that has the contract is a couple of hours away, so that actually adds a lot to their drive time. But I talked with the fellow who's the funeral director for all the TDCJ funerals, and he had some philosophical thoughts about it too, and he talked about just working with all the different families and how every family is kind of in a different place with regard to how they relate to, how they feel about their relative.
Those are some of the, I mean, those are the most powerful scenes in the story to me, were the ones that, you know, the families who, it wasn't as simple as like loving this person and wanting to pay their respects or just totally not wanting to be there, but they had to show up and then just kind of express their mixed feelings one way or another. Or
some pretty extreme expressions.
Or let their little kid express their feelings.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the urinating on the grave.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and then there were other families that former wardens or chaplains told me about who were very glad to be there, and in the way that you're glad to be at any funeral, but they didn't have those sort of harsh feelings toward the person that they lost.
I think it's worth mentioning that one of the things that came across in the story is that these people came from very various walks of life. I mean, outside of being inmates, you have one person who does a lot of research about who's buried in the cemetery. Can you talk about him a little bit?
Sure. That's Franklin Wilson, who is at Indiana State University, and he earned his doctorate at Sam Houston State, which, as I was saying earlier, is right next to the cemetery. And so he is a runner, and he would, on his regular running route, pass the cemetery and just kind of wonder, as I did, what's the deal with this place? What's the story here? And so he was one of the people who maintained that the reason people are there is because their families can't afford to claim them. But he did also point out that there's between 30 and 40 veterans buried there, and their graves actually are marked by different looking grave markers that somebody else has installed that talk about whatever branch they served in. And so the thing that captivated him was, how does somebody start out sort of nobly in their life, I suppose, in the armed services, or in one of the cases that he talked about, serving in Vietnam, and then he traced this person's journey once he came back from Vietnam. This person ended up killing somebody in Texas. He was executed, and then he ended up buried in the prison cemetery. And so I think he was struck, as I was, just by the contrast between someone's life that starts out well and then they end up in this prison cemetery.
Right. You guys have any other questions?
No.
I have something else.
Yeah, go for it.
Have y'all been to Huntsville?
Yeah.
I've driven through.
I just went like three weeks ago.
What'd you think?
It was prettier than I thought it'd be.
It's really pretty.
Yeah.
This was my first two trips to Huntsville. I was struck by how there's a couple things going on. There's the economy is very dominated by the criminal justice system. I think that's the only state agency that's not headquartered in Austin, is the criminal justice system. And there's 5 or 6 prisons in the immediate area, and lots of people's families for generations have worked in them. And then, of course, that's where the executions are. I think as an outsider, it's easy to think Huntsville executions. Right. You know, that's the only thing that you know about it, right?
Right.
But when I got there and I talked to a number of people, both affiliated with the cemetery and not, and discovered that that's almost an aside for them. Perhaps it's because it's routine. They said sometimes they don't even know when there's an execution. It's not top of mind. And so it was just interesting to see the contrast between where people work in Huntsville and then how very ordinary things that strike us as outsiders are perceived by them.
Well, Robin, thank you so much for sharing that story with us.
Thank you.
You can read Robin's story, Laid to Rest in Huntsville, on texasobserver.org. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Joining us now via phone is Houston-based writer Anish Shivani, who reviewed Famous Writers I Have Known, the latest novel from James Magnuson, in the Observer's March issue. Welcome to the show, Anish.
Thank you, Jonathan. Good to be here.
Also with us is the man himself, Mr. James Magnuson, to tell us a little bit more about his book. Thanks for being here, James.
I'm happy to be here.
So what can you tell us about Famous Writers I Have Known?
Well, let's see. The short version is, it's about a small-time con man on the run, passing himself off as the world's most reclusive writer. He ends up teaching in a prestigious writing program somewhere in the heart of Texas, and we proceed from there.
And if you're going to be a writer, I guess somewhere in the heart of Texas is probably a good place to be.
It is.
Right.
It's not bad. Hey, we're a long way from New York. What can I tell you?
Right.
This is true. The bagels are worse, but the barbecue's better.
That's right.
So, Anish, I know you were itching to talk to Mr. Magnuson about his book on the air. What questions do you have for him?
Sure. I was just going to say, Texas is a great place to hide. It's so big that you can hide here.
Exactly.
So, James, it's a pleasure to talk to you. I wanted to ask you, since you've written this novel from the point of view of such an outsider to the literary world, he's a con man, and he's just completely ignorant of the canon, of the techniques of writing, yes, of the art world. What, in your own background, led you to be able to write from that outsider's perspective?
I think there's a couple of things. One is that I'm older. I went to New York in 1964. Uh-huh. There were no such things as writing programs, or at least I didn't know of them, and made my living as a writer, scuffling around. I did plays. I started to publish my first novels, and somehow managed to make my living as a writer for 20 years. So the half of me is, there's a big part of me that is still has some skepticism about this huge industry that seems to have been created. The other thing about being an outsider is, I just thought of, you know, I felt like an idiot a lot in the classroom. You know, there's moments in any teacher's mind, you know, when you say, what in the world is going on? You know, where you... What teacher doesn't feel like a little bit of a fraud at times? So
right.
Even this guy knows is a little ignorant. Honestly, the interesting thing is, to get the tone right, I had to kind of take my own literary opinions out of it, though. I had to bring the tone down. That's what made it funny, you know?
Mm-hmm.
All the three-syllable words became one-syllable words, and I had to cut out all my beautiful physical descriptions because he wouldn't think that way. But that's what you have to do.
Right, you may have had to tone it down, but there's still this sense of connection between, I think, your feelings toward the writing world and your protagonist, because there, I think what you're trying to get across is that it's good to be an interloper, you know, in this world that somehow enhances your writing quality, does it not?
I think that's good. One of the things I've always felt, you know, I've taught for 20 years. I feel I do a good job. I run a program I'm proud of. But there is still in me an essential identity as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And I always manage to get my 3 hours in every day. So I've always had a secret life, I always felt, outside of whatever official role I had. So that's a big part of my life, really, is that actually that sense of distance in a way.
Right. But what you did, you know, you said in the 1960s in New York, that method of coming to writing, and what I tried to do in the 90s too, it seems to be unsustainable in the current economy. It seems like that's not a viable way to go anymore. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, I do agree with that, and I think it's hard. I think so many of the young writers I meet now, when I see them trying to do it, you know, trying to do interviews, articles, the magazines are drying up. Everyone's trying to figure out how to even get published on the internet. And a lot of times, and then if you get published there, how do you get paid for anything?
Right, right.
And the other thing was that when I started, my novels never sold a lot, but I would have an editor who was loyal to me.
Mm-hmm.
I could get a book published about every 2 years, and now it's become so hard. This book that now has gotten wonderful reviews, really, but it was turned down by 30 places.
Right.
I had a heck of a time.
It's always the novels that are turned down by 30 or 60 publishers that turn out to be great, though, right?
I know, exactly.
You have that consolation. Are you ever afraid to disillusion a writer? And was Michener himself like that? Would he just tell you the truth straight out if you weren't a good writer?
That's interesting.
Or do you ever feel like you want to, you know, be almost ruthless in, you know, evaluating a writer's potential?
It's hard, you know. That's a great question. I have to think about answering it, because I'm a natural encourager, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I do think the biggest it's a crime to encourage somebody when they don't have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
So I do feel that I can tell somebody, really, this thing is not working. The other thing is, you go into these MFA programs, you think it's going to happen immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote 3 novels happily that never got published. I just was going to do another one. So, and that's the sense I always saw myself, whether it was true or not, as a little bit of the underdog. Well, I just do, okay, you didn't like that, I'm going to do another one, I'm going to persist. And
right.
I think sometimes you go to these programs, you think, you know, you have some supposedly, well, you have a published novelist, say, reading your work, who's encouraging you. You think it's all going to happen right then.
Right.
And a lot of times it's not. It can be a real slog.
It's the hardest thing in the world to be successful at, or one of the hardest, right? It takes a long time. It's a long slog, yeah. Do you, having finished this novel, how does it make you look back at your journey as a writer? How has that changed? Because I think it took you a long time to write this novel, and as you just said, to get it published too. So do you now look back at your journey differently having done this book?
That's so interesting. That's I probably do. Just talking about this journey as a writer, when I began in New York, I was doing plays, short plays in street theater in Harlem. I began to, some of the early, I had more success with in the theater than anywhere else. And the plays were all funny. They were political. They were a little outrageous. I could never figure out how to write a comic novel. I tried. I couldn't do it. So I began, the novels were, quote, serious and intense in a way.
Right.
And I thought, I want to see if I can get that other voice back.
Right.
It seems like a crime.
Right.
And then for a while I thought, no, as this book kept getting turned down, I kept thinking, wow, I have wasted a huge chunk of my life. Mm-hmm. So the fact that this has been vindicated, I had to go, even my agent, who I love, she'd kind of given up on the book. And I went through a friend who sent it to somebody at Norton. You know, we went sort of around the barn, who read it, got back to me, said there are things that are brilliant. I think it's a little too picaresque. I rewrote it for 9 months or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And then I rewrote it again. So I have to say, it feels a little bit like a miracle.
The book is Famous Writers I Have Known. The author is James Magnuson. James and Anise, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks. Really appreciate it. It was great.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Schulz. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org or pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk at you again next time on Observer Radio.